Shalom and welcome to Neshama Cast, exploring Jewish spiritual care today. Brought to you by Neshama, Association of Jewish Chaplains. I'm your host, Rabbi Ed Bernstein. We are recording on April 1st, 2024. This is a time on the Jewish calendar in which two seemingly contradictory events happen. On the one hand, we are less than a month prior to Passover. Around the Jewish community, people are planning for Passover by cleaning their homes and reflecting on the themes of the Exodus from Egypt to be discussed at the Seder. At the same time, according to the liturgical cycle of the weekly Torah readings, we have recently departed from the book of Exodus, and we are now reading the third book of the Torah, Vayikra, or Leviticus, precisely at the time when the season bids us to reflect on themes coming out of the book of Exodus, the theme of freedom. Our Shabbat Torah readings leave the book of Exodus, and they are concerned with matters of ritual, such as sacrifice, dietary laws, purity, impurity, bodily health, the health of a home, and other ritual matters. Let me bring in Neshama Cast contributor Rabbi Katya Filo. Katya, what does Sefer Vayikra, the book of Leviticus, mean to you?
For me, Vayikra, the book of Leviticus, is all about communication. You look at the beginning, you know, it opens with a call. Vayikra el Moshe vayedaber Adonai elav. Adonai called to Moses and spoke to him, saying, it's different. It's not the usual vayomer yedaber. And then we turn to verse 2, and it continues, and it says, daber bnei Israel ve'amarta aleihem. Speak to the Israelites, say to them. And to me, this asks all kinds of questions about who calls us and how are we called? How do we know that we are called by God? So for me, as a rabbi, as a chaplain, as a human being, the question of what it means to be called into this work and also what it means to be called into being is one that shifts around and that is good to return to from time to time. And the second topic I return to in this context is the topic of korban, of sacrifice. It's a word that literally means to bring near. And versions of this word appear four times just in the second verse. Adam yakriv mikem korban. So when any of you presents an offering of cattle to Adonai, l'Adonai mina be'ema, mina bakar, mina tzon, takrivo et korbanchem. You shall choose your offering from the herd or from the flock. I think this idea of connecting is also crucial for me and my understanding of faith and this God-me communication as well. How do I get closer to God? Although I don't really know if my korban or my attempt at connecting is accepted. And even in general, when I try to speak to someone, I try to draw closer to them. But how do we do that? And then to me also, this other idea that the idea not just the priest, that all Israelites are holy and have jobs to do is just such a powerful notion. Ed, what does Leviticus mean to you?
Well, thank you, Katya. And everything you said resonates to me, and I'll just add to it. Leviticus, to me, is about day-to-day life. Genesis and Exodus contain the grand narratives of the origin of our people. Leviticus picks up and says, okay, so you made it out of Egypt. You're a free nation now. Here's a template for daily life going forward. In this light, the juxtaposition to Passover at this season makes sense. The celebration of freedom in this season is in sync with our reading laws of daily living as a free people, doing what a free people does. The problem is that so many of the rituals in Leviticus are difficult to understand for the modern reader. In college and rabbinical school in the 1990s, I encountered works of modern scholars such as Jacob Milgram and Karen Armstrong who explain the difficult texts and show how they made perfect sense to the ancient biblical readers to whom the texts were initially addressed. However, while the scholars I encountered helped unlock the mysteries of Leviticus, I still struggled as a rabbi, and I was a pulpit rabbi for 18 years. I struggled to make Leviticus meaningful for lay Jews. Then a couple years ago, a chaplain colleague encouraged me to read the book Maps and Meaning, Levitical Models of Contemporary Care, and everything for me changed. Our guest today, Rabbi Nancy Weiner, a co-author of Maps and Meaning, has studied and written about perhaps the most arcane sections of Leviticus, the parts that parents try to avoid when scheduling their children's B'nai Mitzvah. And yet, this book tackles the difficult parts of Leviticus. It taps into the best of contemporary Bible scholarship to explain their meaning and context, while also making these texts relevant to contemporary readers. Rabbi Nancy Weiner is founding director of the Jacob and Hilda Blaustein Center for Pastoral Counseling and is the Dr. Paul and Trudy Steinberg Distinguished Professor in Human Relations at Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in New York City. She is also the co-author with Rabbi Joe Hirschman of this extraordinary book, Maps and Meaning, Levitical Models for Contemporary Care. Rabbi Weiner also serves on the board of Neshama, Association of Jewish Chaplains, where I am honored to serve with her as a colleague. Rabbi Nancy Weiner, welcome to NeshamaCast.
Thank you. It's nice to be here today.
We will soon get into your remarkable scholarship, but first, please tell us a bit of your spiritual and religious backstory in line with all of the other previous guests on the NeshamaCast. What was your spiritual life like growing up, and what was the path that led you to the rabbinate and chaplaincy and Jewish spiritual leadership?
So I was raised in a very committed and active Reform household. My parents actually founded a synagogue in the neighborhood where I was raised because there was no Reform synagogue in the neighborhood.
What neighborhood was that?
It was a part of Newton, Massachusetts, that didn't have a Reform synagogue at the time. And actually, the synagogue met in our living room when I was a very little child. The rhythms of Jewish life were just part of my world from my earliest memories. And being engaged in synagogue and having relationships with rabbis was also part of my world. One of my earliest memories as an elementary school kid was having somebody ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up and saying that I wanted to be a rabbi, which didn't exist back then, and having them say, oh, you'll be a wonderful religious school teacher. But that idea stayed with me and the world changed. Some of my formative experiences as a kid were being an exchange student when I was in high school to Israel the year after the Yom Kippur War, which had a really profound effect on me, not the least of which was recognizing that the impact of that war on the kids that I was in high school with who were preparing to go off 2 years later and serve was raising all sorts of questions for them about what it meant to be defending a country and to feel that they were profoundly aware of the horrors of war and the losses because one of the battalions that was decimated in Sinai was kids who had been at the high school that I was attending. I sort of fought with myself about whether or not I wanted to pursue going into the rabbinate or not and went and did other things, including teaching junior high school Spanish and living in Spain and working in international business. And the more I did things radically apart from the Jewish community, the more I realized how much I wanted to be a part of a world where it was centered. Before going to rabbinical school, I went to Columbia and got a master's degree in Jewish history and loved the studying, but also realized that I was getting into areas that were tremendously exciting for me, but very esoteric for other people, and wanted to be more engaged with the contemporary Jewish community and decided to go into the rabbinate at that point.
I'm really interested in hearing a bit more about how you navigate your many identities as an academic, as a rabbi, as a chaplain. I'm a former academic who went to rabbinical school and trained as a chaplain, and I'm about to return to university life as a university chaplain. But what does it mean for you to be an academic and someone who spans a bridge to the wider world? And how do you help students develop tools to be more caring humans as they begin their careers?
So I see what I do now as the bridge that I was seeking when I left pure academia and went to rabbinical school. I don't see the worlds as being separate. I see them informing each other and interacting with each other in really exciting and synergistic ways. And that just the pure academic or intellectual understanding of something is lacking and needs the complementary real life world to find its application. And so I find it really wonderful to be studying different things in depth that are multidisciplinary, which is really how my mind works. And then to realize that that same complementarity that can exist and the fusion of fields is a reflection of the complexity of every human being. And so to be able to sit down with another human being and to be able to listen and see and experience on multiple levels that human being or a community, and to be able to be open to hearing what it is that they're bringing and what it is that their needs are, and to be able to draw on my own religious sensibilities as well as the knowledge that I have, feels like a gift to me and a gift that I can bring to the world. By being at a seminary, I find that I'm actually in a world where all of those different disciplines are honored and where my time with students is intentionally a fusion of sparking their intellectual curiosity and helping them understand that it's their humanity ultimately that they're bringing out into the world. And if they don't know themselves and they don't care for themselves, they can't be there and care for others.
Rabbi Weiner, let's jump into your scholarship, which I've been looking forward to discussing with you. Your book, Maps and Meaning, that you co-authored with Rabbi Joe Hirschman. I'd like to ask you if you could talk about the basic premise, the thesis of the book, and also what prompted you to write it.
So we began by asking the question of if there were any models for us as contemporary chaplains and pastoral caregivers for the work that we do that we could find in classic Jewish texts. And so we started by looking at the Metzora, who was really the primary example of someone who had some sort of condition that could be seen as an illness that was uncertain in its duration, and where there were clearly ways in which, in this case, the priest was an ongoing presence for the Metzora.
And just to contextualize, what is the Metzora and where do we find that condition?
The Metzora is found in Leviticus, primarily in chapters 13 and 14, and the Metzora is incorrectly translated as the person with leprosy. There is nothing that indicates that this is leprosy at all. And we started studying what Tzara'at was, what the condition was, and the person who had the condition, the Metzora, and how different strata of Jewish literature understood and related to the Metzora. What we realized was that we needed to understand the ways in which the biblical narrative constructed the world, and that in order to understand what was going on with the Metzora, who was required to spend time outside of the camp where the rest of the Israelites were, meant that we needed to understand what the camp was, what the regions outside the camp were, and how people navigated transitions from being within or spending time outside of the camp. This resonated with us in terms of times that people spend outside of the normal bounds of community, and in our world, the Jewish community, and what it meant for the religious leader of the community to have access to both the community that was in the encampment, or say in our normative institutions and communities, and what it is to have access also and to be required to spend time with those who were outside of the camp. And we started thinking of maps, hence the title of the book. There was a mental map that everyone in the community held of what was in the camp, what was outside the camp, who was in, who had to spend time outside of the camp. In addition to those with Tzara'at, there was a military camp that was outside the camp, and there were other individuals who at times needed to spend time outside the camp. And one of the things that we noted was that there was the Ohel Moed inside the camp, which was the primary precinct where holiness resided, and where where the priest had access to all of the precincts of the Ohelmoed. And then there was another place where God could be found outside the camp, a different Ohelmoed, which was not bound by the rigid rituals that took place within the Ohelmoed within the camp, but seemed to be a place where if somebody found themselves outside the camp and needed to be communicating with God, they could go there. We dubbed it the Tent of Special Appointments. It was like you made a special appointment to convene with God when you were outside the camp, and you could momentarily have the opportunity to commune with God. Again, we thought of resonances with contemporary people who might be outside the camp, with the spaces that are set aside in hospitals for chapels, or for, say, kids who might be at camp for the summer. There were places where they would go, which would be the places where everybody would gather for special meetings. And in the military camp, we were really taken by the idea that God walks in the camp with the soldiers while they're out there, that God can be present, though we tend to think of God's presence being in the Ohelmoed that's in the camp. God is momentarily present for those who are outside the camp as well, which we found very powerful. So there was this geographic map that we could draw out. And then there was a secondary map that seemed to overlay that, which had to do with two different things. One was holiness and where holiness could reside. And then there were states of being that were recognized as in flux, where something could be either tahor, usually translated as pure, or tameh, regularly translated as impure. And that in order for God to dwell in the Ohelmoed, there had to be both only things that were holy there and things that were tahor. And so we started mapping out where there were areas where there could be both things that were tameh and tahor, where things that were holy could or could not be, and realized that while it was arcane and really confusing for us as moderns, that it seemed like the ancient Israelites held both of these maps and therefore could live their lives guided by these two overlaid maps. And that if somebody was diagnosed with tzara'at, they understood that that meant that they couldn't be in the camp with everybody else because they ran the risk of causing other people to become tameh, and they would move outside the camp, but would know that there were clear ways for them to move back into being with the rest of the community again once the condition subsided. And so we started thinking about the ways in which our society does and doesn't understand what was embedded in these biblical texts. We translated for ourselves somebody whose tameh is somebody whose world is out of balance, where the equilibrium that they've known is suddenly thrown off, and they're unable to function in the world in the ways that they've known and that people have known them to be able to function in. So, for example, we know, and our tradition is very, very strong and clear about the idea that after a death, we don't function the way that we normally do. And it builds in all sorts of ways for us to not be expected to function as we do when we're not confronted with the death of somebody in our immediate world. We don't have anything parallel for that built in for us as moderns and Jews in the modern world. When there's disease or some sort of other thing that completely unmoors us and throws us into a state of not knowing how to function and feeling unbalanced in the world, we seem to be functioning in a world where if I'm sick today, I'm supposed to be fine tomorrow. If I've had something major go on in my life, say I've lost a job or I've experienced something that was emotionally really jarring, that I'm supposed to brush myself off and go about my daily life. Whereas in Leviticus, we learn that when you've been in a situation that has been completely disorienting and thrown your equilibrium off, you need to not only go through a set of rituals that help you acknowledge the ways in which your inner and outer being have been affected, but that you also need time. You need time to transition back, and you need time to just get used to being back in the world that you've known, and for people to get used to your being back in that world as well. And one of the most striking images for us was when the Metsora returned to the camp. The Metsora sat at the entrance of their tent for a week, just being there, not expected to be engaging with the community again, not expected to do any of the normal things that they had done, but just to get used to being back there and for the community to get used to seeing them again. We inferred for them to get used to being back in the company of their family in their tent, because everybody in that tent was equally affected by their being outside the camp, though they weren't necessarily the person who was being identified as being the one who needed attention.
In the mindset of the biblical author, it seems like there's not a moral judgment of the Metsora. It's just something that happens, right? And there's a procedure in place for when someone has this disease, something or someone is impure. We're not casting aspersions on that person. It's just there's a procedure that you have to follow. Is that right?
Yes. Two pieces of that I'd like to unpack a little bit. One is that there's no moral judgment, which we still have for many diseases and many conditions that people have. That was a much later rabbinic overlay.
You're talking about the motzi shemra,
yes.
The gossiping connection.
Right, tied with Miriam.
Yeah, because Miriam in Numbers chapter 12 is afflicted with sara'at for speaking gossip about Moses. So she is afflicted with some sort of skin ailment. And so the rabbis make a connection between that and Leviticus. There must be some sort of moral judgment. But in the mindset of the author of Leviticus at the time it was being written for the audience for whom it was written, there was no understanding of any moral culpability of someone who had sara'at. It was just something that happened.
It was just something that happened. And one of the most striking things for us was that even when required to be outside the camp, the person was never seen as not in relationship with God and not in relationship with the community. Those ties endured and were being affirmed in multiple ways, even during the sojourn of the person outside the camp, by the priest visiting weekly and spending time with them, by there being a way to communicate with God with that Ohel Moed that was outside the camp. And that we tend to stigmatize people who are on the margins, whereas in this set of mental maps that our ancestors seem to have, there was no stigmatization at all. And in fact, one of the readings that we thought was really interesting, many people have read the requirement of the Metsora to rend their clothes and grow their hair and muss it up and to wear veil over their lip and to walk around saying, Tame, Tame, as being the ultimate shaming. We read it in the context of all of the other laws that go along with the Metsora as a way of the person saying, I'm hurting. In case you didn't notice, I'm hurting and I need support. And this is affecting me inside and outside, and my whole world is turned upside down. Please pay attention to that. It matters. It matters to me, and it matters to you as a community as well. The extension of that is that when Miriam is outside the camp, the encampment can't move. Everyone is at a standstill because the absence of that person and the interconnectivity between the people who are on the margin and the people in the center hasn't been eradicated. And so they can't move because she can't move at that moment either.
Yeah, I wanted to come back to the first concept you talked about, which talks about being outside of the camp, mechutz lemechaneh. I was really taken by the fluidity of this concept, where in the book you describe that there is this, and I quote, this very territory that's in that has the potential to become outside and vice versa as well. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about this. Who is mechutz lemechaneh today?
I think in many ways in contemporary, certainly Jewish and American society, there are people who are differently abled who are still mechutz lemechaneh. We haven't fully been able to figure out how to integrate people into our broader world or to expand our boundaries. One of the other groups I know that certainly among my students, there's a lot of concern about how the borders and boundaries of the Jewish community as it has existed is responding to non-binary and trans Jews. in my generation, that same set of questions was being asked about lesbian and gay Jews. And that's a great example of how the boundaries have shifted. Those questions are not dominating now. It's just in many sectors of the Jewish world, it's just understood that that boundary has now encompassed that group that was once marginalized, and that the parameters of the camp shift. And the fact that you and I are recognized as rabbis in the world is another example of a boundary that seemed really fixed that moved, and moved such that the people who didn't know the world before women could be ordained as a reality now understand the camp as that's the camp. That's what we know. That's what we live with. One of the things that we found really striking was that while we tend to tell the stories of the Israelites on their journeys as the camp, as if the camp remained a static place, that every time they moved, the parameters of the camp shifted entirely, so that the place where one would imagine perhaps the Matsora was the week before is now where the center of the camp is today, or where the military camp was as the vanguard for the movement in the desert is now the center of the camp, and that vanguard is another however many meters ahead of that. And that everybody learns to adapt and adjust to that. Even though we all tend to chafe at change, it's a constant. And so that map of the Israelite camp and Michutz LaMachaneh is just a real strong reminder of both our adaptability and the need to be ready to move, because things are never constant and not in flux in some way.
To add to this, how do you see the role of chaplains changing? Now, how do chaplains reflect the former role of priests, for example? But how is it shifting? You know, just as the role of the camp and who's in and out is shifting, so certainly our role is shifting as well.
For many years, the role of chaplain was identified with very, very specific institutions. There was the military chaplain, there was the campus chaplain, and there was the hospital chaplain, basically the healthcare chaplain. And our understanding of chaplain has exploded in the last number of years in terms of our understanding that there can be chaplains not only at universities, but at schools of all different kinds. There can be movement chaplains, there can be chaplains who are community chaplains. There can be chaplaincy that's provided remotely. We've really started to understand the role of chaplain and the need for spiritual accompaniment as being something that is more universal than the very limited ways that we had been perceiving it before.
To pick up on that, the modern Hebrew term in Israel for chaplain is malveh ruchani, or the action is livui ruchani. And there's a close connection between malveh or livui and Levi, the Levites. Can you comment on that connection and elaborate on that and how chaplains fill the role parallel to the priests?
Sure. So that was one of the things that we noted in the book. The Levi is the one who accompanies people through the different rituals that they engage in, both in and outside the camp. But also the biblical priest had two additional major roles in terms of accompanying people both within as they left and as they returned to the camp. So the idea of accompanying struck us as a literal sort of visual, I'll walk with you as you are within the camp, I'll walk with you as you cross its boundaries, and I'll walk with you while you are outside. And that was precisely what the Levitical priest did with the Matsora, but it's also what the Levitical priest did with those who were about to engage in military service. They would be there with basically at what would be the corollary to their induction ceremony, visibly there, giving them a blessing, helping them understand what their responsibilities were, as well as what their exemptions might be and what the risks were that they were about to encounter. And then when the battle was over and the troops were returning, the priest would go out of the camp and meet them outside the camp as part of their welcome back, but also as a way of saying, and you need time, and you need to cleanse yourselves, and you need to somehow digest the range of experiences that you've had that have been so yotzei min haklal, so out of the ordinary for the typical person in the encampment, that you need to go through these steps, and I will be here to help you go through these steps before you can re-enter civilian life. And that, again, that level of being present and accompanying step by step is part of what we as contemporary chaplains do as well, and what all of us who offer spiritual care, no matter the venue, and certainly our colleagues who are in congregational life, do it all the time with people across the lifespan as they are accompanying them through all the transitions that they go through.
I wanted to just revisit one thing in terms of the Metsora in the scholarship. Like Professor Milgram, he mentions the Metsora when there's bodily illness, it's a reminder of death. So back when I encountered Milgram 30 some years ago, and I encountered that theory, and he says it's not a judgmental thing. It's just, according to the biblical author, there cannot be a reminder of death within the precincts of the dwelling place of the living God. That's what I recall from his scholarship. I'm just playing with that metaphor in terms of how we bring that into the modern world. It seems like, to some extent, we may have more modern ways of doing things, but in some ways, people who remind us of our mortality are still kind of put outside the camp, in hospitals and nursing homes, and it's the chaplains who bridge those two worlds. But I'm just wondering if you can comment on modern society today, that we still basically have the same construct as the ancients did. We might use different names, but what does it mean for us that we still don't like to be reminded of our mortality?
I think we are actually worse at being in the presence of death and our own mortality, or any reminder of it, than any prior generations. Most people are so removed from it because of the institutions that we've created, where we relegate people who are ill or dying so that you have to make a special effort to be in their presence, as opposed to people being sick and dying at home for most of human history, that we have, from my perspective, a lot of educating to do so that that separation doesn't seem like it has to be, or that it should be, normative, so that we nurture new generations of kids, and then when they become adults, of people who are just used to going to nursing homes and who are comfortable going and visiting people in hospitals and don't get anxious when they have to go do a Shiva call, that these are just parts of life, and that showing up matters, and that accompaniment is not just something that those of us who are trained to do can do, but that everybody can hear of somebody who is in need and be responsive and feel a responsibility to respond and to show somebody that they're not alone. And I think that that is the biggest tragedy of our having these places outside the camp, that people feel that only those who have license to go to those places can go to them. And that it's in many ways up to those of us who have that license to dispel that perception and to keep inviting people to come and to be with us and to be with the people who hopefully will, back to the metaphor of the ever-changing boundaries of the camp, that those places that are currently outside the camp will become places within the camp again, where people will feel that, of course, they have access, that they should be part of the daily lives of people who today they don't have access to.
The last chapter of Maps and Meaning is titled The Priest, Prophet, and Pastor in Each of Us. And you begin that chapter with a quote from Primo Levi, and I quote, "In order for the wheel to turn, for life to be lived, impurities are needed. And the impurities of impurities in the soil, too, as is known, if it is to be fertile. Dissension, diversity, the grain of salt and mustard are needed. Fascism does not want them, forbids them. It wants everybody to be the same. Immaculate virtue does not exist either. Or if it exists, it is detestable." End of quote. How do you use this quotation in the chapter? How does the priest, the prophet, and the pastor exist in each of us?
We each have the possibility of accompanying other people in meaningful ways. We have the possibility of helping people name what's going on in their lives and to feel that they deserve to be recipients of care and attention. Like the ancient priests, each of us has the possibility of appreciating the small and large things that distinguish one person from another without passing judgment on their moral viability. And for me, the prophetic piece is to be able to do two things simultaneously. One is to be able to hear what somebody is not yet ready to articulate, sort of like hearing the still small voice. And the other is being able to hear the story of an individual and to be able to recognize when it's indicative of a larger story or problem that is actually society's issue. And then to say, and as an individual who has heard this story or has become aware of this issue, I need to take action and I need to help others become aware of that. The ancient priest was paying attention to the smallest details. And we tend not to pay attention to the small details that people share with us. We're looking for the big splashy things. And if we can become more attuned to the small things that people share and to recognize that they'll share those small things first, and then we can get deeper and deeper if we've received those with love and care and concern. And then we can draw nearer to each other, back to your early comment, right? What is it to be drawn close to another individual? And how does drawing close to individuals and members of communities help us draw closer to God and to ourselves? Those are things that transcend, I hope, the area of the world that clergy inhabit or pastoral caregivers inhabit, and are things that every human being can offer to another human being.
Rabbi Weiner, I believe you recently organized a major conference on pastoral care at the Blaustein Center. What was the conference about, and how did you apply your scholarship to the conference, and did it include any takeaways that you want to comment about?
On March 7th, we celebrated the 25th anniversary of the Blaustein Center for Pastoral Counseling. There were a couple of different components to the day. One was a public program where I spoke about the history of what we'd done, but also where I spoke about the ways in which pastoral caregivers are invited into other people's holy of holies, and the ways in which, just as in the sacrificial system, there were all sorts of things that other people don't have access to and that sometimes can be really, really messy, but that there's a holiness in that moment of revelation that somebody else will bring to us as chaplains that is transformative for them and for us, and that really helps us experience something that is transcendent. And I also spoke about the ways in which we are often in a position of listening to what's hard to hear, to something that has shattered somebody's heart, and that hearing it is heart-shattering for us. And that it's precisely learning how to hold what is shared with us, seeing and hearing that individual, reflecting on it in terms of what it means for us as the human beings that we are, and in light of our tradition, that helps us eventually remain present to hear what's hard to hear, and that that is a gift that we have. For me, that also relates back to part of what we wrote in the book in terms of the chatat offering.
The sin offering.
And that the priest couldn't eat of his own chatat, had to bring it outside the camp, and that we too need the supports both from our tradition and from our training, et cetera, to be able to do the work that we do and to continue to do it. We also, I gathered Jewish CPE supervisors and people who teach pastoral counseling at Jewish seminaries for a day of learning together, which ended up being a really powerful day for us to be reflecting on the impact of our understanding of what we do in light of October 7th, and also to be thinking about the ways that we can intentionally be looking at what we do as complementary contributing factors to the nurturance of the next generation of rabbis, cantors, and pastoral caregivers. One of the things that emerged from those discussions was that we really have found ourselves back to one of the impetuses for writing the book, in territory that we've never been in before. None of us have tried to offer care or to understand ourselves in the world as it now exists. And the idea of trying to figure out what helps us remain moored when our moorings have been pulled out from underneath us, and how we maintain a sense of being oriented in the world when our axes of orientation have been thrown off in major ways.
Yeah, October 7th really has thrown us off our communal axis. We're recording at a particularly challenging time. It's nearly 180 days, nearly 6 months after the attacks of October 7th, 2023. The metaphor of mechutz lemachane, outside the camp, seems apt for so much of the Jewish world today. There are the survivors of the actual terror and the trauma that entails. There are soldiers at war. There are Jews around the world who have been ostracized and some literally thrown out of their political camps because they are Jews. You've spoken a little bit, but can you go a little deeper? How are you making sense out of all of this? Are there additional ways to apply your work in Maps and Meaning to help us draw a fresh roadmap through these turbulent times?
So one of the things that has been really striking for me is that the ancient priest could contract tzara'at. So the idea that the communal leaders, the communal spiritual leaders, could know what it was like to be themselves afflicted by something that threw them completely off whack and placed them outside of the world that they've known and understood and know how to navigate, really has tremendous resonance for me right now in terms of all of us as pastoral caregivers. We are trying to offer care at the same time that we are completely in territory that is vaguely familiar, but not, we've never lived here before. We visited, but we've never lived here before in this way. And that we all need to be drawing on the Ohel Moed that's outside the camp, because we have needs that we've never had before either. And they're individual as well as collective. And I think that there's a real power in the Haftarah that goes with Mitzorah for us to be thinking about, we're all sitting outside the camp right now, but it doesn't mean that we have to all be alone. The Mitzoraim found each other and they found some purpose, and they found, even in the threats that abounded around them and the spoils that they came across, potential for hope and a recreation of what they needed and wanted. But it wasn't easy and it wasn't immediately apparent. The other thing that I've been thinking about with regard to the work that we did on this book and October 7th is the elaborate rituals that were in place for the warriors to return, fly in the face of the way that the Israeli military has always functioned, to go from being in Miluim right now and going home for Shabbat and then going back to the front is so mind-blowing and such a huge demand placed upon the returning soldier for the weekend, the family for the weekend, the whole community for the weekend, and for all of them to have to be shifting back and forth is huge. And friends that I've spoken with who are therapists and spiritual caregivers in Israel have been commenting on the number of people who have been commenting on this in recent months. It's a real area for serious thought to be given about how we can be supporting both what is the norm in terms of weekly rhythms for people who are in the army, and also to be supporting the soldiers and their families with this sustained war, which nobody has ever lived through in Israel like this before either.
Rabbi Weiner, as we draw near our conclusion, I'm wondering if you have any additional messages you have on chaplaincy, Leviticus, the upcoming holiday of Pesach, Passover, managing challenging times, or anything else on your mind.
I've been thinking a lot about the description of Pharaoh throughout the plagues and the repetition of the hardening of the heart, and wondering what it is for us to look at ourselves and to see the ways in which, as we've been feeling assaulted and thrown off whack, how we make sure our hearts aren't hardening and how we might continue to push ourselves to keep listening. And there's a description in Exodus 7 of Pharaoh just turning away and going home. Like, I've had enough. I'm going to cover my ears and cover my eyes, and I'm not going to pay attention to the plagues going on around me. I'm not going to listen to what anybody's saying. I'm on overload. And how much that impulse exists in all of us, and how at a time of tremendous stress and anxiety, particularly as caregivers, we might have the impulse, when I'm not at work, I just want to do that. But what it does for us if that is the only impulse that we're leaning towards, and what for our own care and our own sustenance would be missed if that's where we head.
Rabbi Nancy Weiner, I feel like I could talk to you all day, but I want to thank you at this moment for joining us on Neshama Cast. And I want to note that your service and scholarship are a blessing to all of us. And I pray that you will be blessed with good health and strength to continue your sacred work.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure talking with you.
Neshama Cast is a production of Neshama, Association of Jewish Chaplains. Thank you to our guest, Rabbi Nancy Weiner. Check our show notes for more information about her and additional resources, including texts referenced in the discussion and a glossary of Hebrew terms. Thank you to Rabbi Katya Filo for participating in today's interview and for her production assistance. Additional thanks for logistical support to Allison Atterbury, NAJC Acting Executive Director, and Rabbi Drew Kaplan and the NAJC Social Media Committee. Transcripts for this episode and other episodes of Neshama Cast are available at neshamacast.simplecast.com. Our theme music is A Nigun for Ki'anu Amecha, written and performed by Reb Cantor Lisa Levine. Please help others find the show by rating and reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts. We welcome comments and suggestions for future programming at neshamacast@gmail.com. And be sure to follow NAJC on Facebook to learn more about Jewish spiritual care happening in our communities. May we all work together to heal our world. Lie, lie, lie.